Let me just tell you a little bit about what we're doing and then try and get into it. The discussion is revolving around this book, American Civil Religion, by Ritchie and Jones, which was ordered, but my prophecy is it'll arrive the day that I leave or something like that. And this is a collection of about 10, 12 essays by folks, mostly sociologists, historians, some theologians, and one Englisher, on the theme of American civil religion. The phrase, just that way, American civil religion, began to be used in religious circles and sociology circles too, in 67 when Robert Bella, a sociologist, coined it out of some study, some hints in Rousseau that he had been reading, and traced what he felt was a very specific kind of religion going on alongside of the others. This is the famous line that he is quoted most for is, "Few have realized that there actually exists alongside of and rather clearly differentiated from the churches an elaborate and well institutionalized civil religion in America." And that's what he begins to write about. I chose in the 3 days here to deal with Bella's essay the first day, with Martin Marty's essay the second day, and the third day today, Herbert Richardson's response. Broadly said, Bella tends to say American civil religion ain't so bad because it's sort of essential to the development of a country or of any group, and so you have to be very careful about whacking away at it. He writes an essay at the end of the book where he's a little less intrigued by it, but he still comes down somewhat in favor. Martin Marty has a sort of a middle road on it. He talks about two kinds of civil religion, the one which has a transcendent God in judgment of what's going on, and the other, the first two kinds are, the other is a self-transcendence in which the country really becomes the God. But even within those, he thinks there are variations, and he's really not so sure how true it is, that it is a religion beyond a sociologist or historian's point of view. So that's where Marty is. Richardson today is zap against it, thinks it's real, demonic, and ought to be attacked like mad. So that's where we are. So we'll sound, the quotes and stuff will sound lots more anti today, obviously, than it did in the last 2 days. To get into it, each day we've chatted a little bit. Today I'd like to ask if you would have any response to what does the flag mean to you? One of the cardinal symbols of American civil religion would be the American flag. But I'm asking you, what does the flag mean to you? Or what does it mean to anybody as far as you're concerned? Anybody? What's the flag?
It used to mean a lot more. I don't know what happened to me. But I used to feel a lot more reverence for the thing itself. And we used to, you know, knock ourselves out getting the flag outside the house on Flag Day and the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the transition came. Must have been in those turbulent 60s that... I don't do that anymore. In fact, I can't even figure out where it is in the house. You know, well, my house is here. You know, but I don't have that reverence anymore.
Okay. Somebody else? Yeah. You just talk.
When the national anthem is played and it's raised at certain ceremonies, I know if it's the morning or what, but I get all choked up.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's the flag or if it's just the whole
setting,
what's happening.
It has all kinds of military connotations in my mind. When I see flag, I think Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or something like that. And for that reason, it isn't real meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it still makes me mad when people use it for a window curtain or sew it on the seat of their pants. And I don't understand that if I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anybody else? Yeah.
For me, it's a symbol of what America was meant to be, kind of the embodiment of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I see it as a very idealistic kind of thing. I don't equate it with military or the negative kinds of things that I feel or know about our country. That doesn't enter in it. And then also kind of the full embodiment of the history of our country in terms of pioneers and the people who struggled to make it a nation. I leave out all the bad stuff and just think about the good stuff.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what I do too. Like, I try to make it what I think would be valuable. Trying to do something and be responsible person in the democratic system, and I make fun of it when it's out at the local military reservation. Make fun in other ways. It shouldn't bother me, but I have enough place where I said it.
Uh-huh.
It's a meeting.
Yeah.
To me, it's home. You know, I don't revere it and I don't disdain it. It means that this is. It's part of where I live. And like in traveling abroad or anything, it's,
yeah.
That's me. It's kind of comfortable. It's part of my identity. Good and bad.
Okay.
I guess in the instances where you see it flying with flags of other countries, it loses the negative for me, and I identify with it a whole lot more.
What does it mean to you when you see it in a lapel?
American Legion.
You, pardon?
But I probably don't think like that person, and I'll be a little careful in my approach.
Mm-hmm. What happens if you do mess around with the flag?
What do you mean mess around?
Well, treat it badly.
I don't.
Well, if one would, what would happen?
Most likely nothing, but there are laws against it.
Oh, yeah. Could be arrested, right? It's an institutionalized symbol. It is what we vest it with, to be sure. But it's also legal requirements. Do you folks have annual flag burnings led by the American Legion locally so that the flag is, it's not supposed to be thrown out? You're supposed to give it to somebody who will, pro forma, get rid of it. So no flag is, there's a way of taking care of it. And there are regulations for how to fly it, right? A right way and a wrong way. The liturgy of the flag is a very serious one in the history of the country. I'm not trying to put that down or anything. I'm just saying that a part of the aspect of the flag is that there are liturgies related to it, like saluting and holding your hand over your heart, to be sure. Like certain days you ought have it up, certain ways you ought fly it, certain things you ought not do with it. So it's a fairly highly institutionalized dimension or institutionalized symbol. Yeah.
I think, I guess the first time that really hit me the strongest is to remember back to John Kennedy's funeral.
Yeah.
And just about the thing that stands out to me, that whole thing, a number of things.
Yeah.
But the ceremony of the holding of the flag and handing to
sure.
Jackson was like the climax of the whole
sure.
thing.
Well, that ritual, again, associated with death, of a military, normally military hero, and that's why he did receive it. It wasn't because he was president, but because he was commander-in-chief and had been in the military, that the flag became a, now I would be interpreting more, an ultimate symbol. It is saved for that in the play, in the drama, which is a military funeral. It is the key, the high point, the focal point of the drama. And so its liturgy is very strong that way too. Anybody else about the flag? It would be clear that, as we talked about it here again, we're talking about America that's not implying at all that it's different than other countries. It may well be and all that. There may be some differences, but I wouldn't want to say that it is a strong difference between countries on that score. All right. Now, we go on to the chapter that I wanted to deal a little bit with today, Civil Religion in Theological Perspective, as done by Herbert Richardson. Herbert Richardson is a... where is he a prof? I forgot. In Toronto, the Toronto School of Theology, St. Michael's College and Toronto School of Theology, and is a strong a person who is endeavoring to do what is, in quotes, called an American theology, trying to get at categories and understandings and ways of talking that deal with this country, this experience, and this kind of continent, and this age. He has a very, I think, very difficult book called Toward an American Theology. One of the questions I ask anybody going to theological school today is, did you get an American theological education? That's an interesting question. There probably, some of my friends who are theological professors assume that there maybe are two at the most, or maybe three at the most, schools where you can get an American theological education today. Because most of the guys are trained in Europe, or trained by guys who are trained in Europe, and tend to come very strongly out of those categories. And I'm not saying those are bad, but there might be something more to it. And Richardson is a guy committed to that. Whether good or bad, you'd have to judge, and I'd be willing to judge too, but that's what he's sort of about. In this respect, though, he has four sections in what he does. In the first one, he says why he thinks it's dangerous. And that's these two things happen when you link religion with any other thing. First, we ascribe to that thing some ultimate value or transcendent meaning. He thinks that automatically when you unite religion with some other kind of a thing, if it would be with chess or with whatever it would be, you begin to ascribe to that thing some ultimate value or transcendent meaning just because you are linking it with religion. And if patriotism or the civil state is being linked with religion in some way, he thinks you are automatically ascribing some ultimate value to it. That's automatically what's going on. Secondly, the thing that happens, Richardson says, when we link up a religion with some other aspect of life is that we conceive ultimate reality as if it resembled this thing. So that if we say religion and chess, we begin to give to chess a feeling that it's pretty ultimate. It's a really, there's something important about it, or you wouldn't put religion with it. Now, why in the world you would, I don't know, but for the moment, do that. But at the same time, you begin to then, the chess model becomes a way of thinking about religion. And I guess you can see then what he's saying, that if religion begins attached to the civil state, you give to the state a feeling that it's ultimate, that there's something about it that is beyond just the ordinary experience. But at the same time, you begin to think about religion in terms of the state. And both of those, for Richardson, are highly dangerous things. You think both of those will get us into a heck of a lot of trouble. A way of modeling or picturing what God is and our relationship to him, he feels, comes out of associating religion with the American scene. American civil religion not only gives to America more than he thinks it maybe he thinks that it deserves, but also sets us up for thinking about God in terms of the way we live as Americans. So he tries to he wants to get behind that. We want first analyze sociologically and historically that Americans have developed a unique civil religion through which they express their faith that politics is a matter of ultimate concern. He believes that's what's going on. And then secondly, he wants to ask what it means to think of God in political terms. For example, as a king who rules. Those political terms. Or through law, which requires obedience. And he thinks that these are the things that would be going on. Well, he goes on. One function of the civil religion is to legitimate and control the use of political power in a society. This is how he sees what's going on when we associate religion and politics. to legitimate and control the use of political power. The questions we must ask are, how are the institutions of the political order to be valued and controlled? Do we have a better civitas, a better state, when we regard political institutions and activities as having ultimate value? Is it make it better? That's a question. Or do we have a better polis, a better civil state, when we refuse to take politics with religious seriousness and reject the notion that any nation has special responsibilities, quote, under God? The very ultimacy or unconditionedness with which many Americans approach politics could well be destructive of the civil order rather than truly constructive. Just as a person who plays chess or football with religious seriousness has lost so much sense of proportion that he actually ruins the game, at least so Richardson believes. So people who approach politics as if ultimate moral and religious issues were at stake may also be destroying the political process itself. Some things go better, Richardson says, if we value them less. But he goes on, he says, how can we control human politics and law if we value them less? How can we order the life of a nation unless we relate it to a higher transcendent norm? How can we limit human pretensions to absolute power unless we bring those pretensions under a higher sovereignty of God? How can we maintain human freedom unless we believe it to be a divine gift? What better way is there to limit the institutions and activities of the state than in the light of the highest ideals, its civil religion? That's some of the questions he wants to get at. He thinks those are serious questions. Okay? He goes back to say how how Bella lays out what he thinks that's about, and that's that quote that I read to you before. It may be, he thinks, that the misuse of civil religion is generated by the very structure of civil religion itself. It may be that it has to be abused just even to exist. But he says, when any political party identifies its program with a utopian vision and the kingdom of God, and by the way, Bella points out that all of the presidents except one did that. And the president is seen as the high priest of civil religion. Whenever that's happened, the more justified the state feels in pursuing this program with unqualified zeal, and less likely the state will be to accept criticism and compromise. So the more earnestly anyone strives to attain a transcendent and divine ideal, the more likely he will be to regard himself and his strivings as righteous. In other words, we begin to say, this is the way God really wants a country to be, the less we are going to be able to say, we made a mistake, or it isn't quite right yet. We tend to make it ultimate right away. Yes. Is there any other way of limiting and controlling political power? Normally, he says, religion means to bind together. Religion is those feelings, symbols, and acts that bind a group together. And since there are many groups, there are many religions. A person can be a member of many at one and the same time. With regard to this argument, I believe there can be no serious misunderstanding. That's the way it really is. He thinks Bella is wrong in saying it's a good thing, and I mentioned this the other day already, when Bella says that that's what happens in any group. You have to have an ideal that holds the group together, like Holden has an ideal. The first day we talked about the civil religion of Holden, and it's probably there's a very, very real one here. So, but you have to have an ideal to hold the group together. Richardson says Bella is wrong when he applies that to the state, because the state rules out groups. The very nature of the state as a national outfit wants less importance on the groups. It doesn't want a strong South. It doesn't want a strong North. It doesn't want a strong West, a strong East. It wants unity. It doesn't want a strong intellectual movement. It doesn't want a strong worker movement. It doesn't want a strong minority movement. It doesn't want a strong women's movement. It wants everything to be whole. Everything is subservient to the national. And that's what Bella says is wrong. Because whenever that happens, then the national quickly becomes the decider of who shall be what all the way along the line. and it is the existence of the strains, what he would call nations. He contrasts nation and state. Nation implies a number of nations, like the Indians apparently, you know, talk about the Sioux Nation and all the rest, that there ought to be nations within our state. And what our state tends to do is wipe them out so that the nationalism, the statism, becomes the controlling force. So he ends up by saying, while therefore civil religion may be inevitable, the national form of civil religion in America is not inevitable and is certainly wrong, according to Richardson. Okay? Well, he spent some time working that out. Let me go on. Then he goes on to theological questions. Every group generates an idealized vision of itself that can be accepted as a model of human relationship to ultimate reality. The question is, how should person proportion his time and energies, and to which group should he give greater loyalties? We begin to belong to a lot of groups. Which one gets priority? Is it family? Is it church? Is it job? Is it nation? Is it what? This practical decision about investment of feeling and energy reveals the implicit theological judgment about which aspects of life are more important to human fulfillment. He contends American civil religion would say that your giving of yourself to the state is the ultimate one. Family goes aside. You leave the family and go to war if it's necessary. The church would be less important because the church is all little pieces. It's not one. And so it is not important as the state, which is seen to be one. Or your job, certainly. Well, he's working for the government, you know. Automatically. I always wanted to buy one of those seals, you know, that it says government vehicle. I wanted to have, you know, they make them now for taxpayer vehicles. And I wanted to have one on the side of my car because it'll give me the prestige of being part of the group. Go on. Let me get to where he says, Americans tend to believe that political groups and their symbolisms and values are more important than other groups and their symbolisms. I don't know if you accept that or not. Richardson maintains that Americans tend to believe that political groups and their symbolisms and values are more important than other groups and their symbolisms. Americans talk and act as if the ultimate questions of human life are being decided in the realm of politics. And Americans believe that political categories have a special appropriateness for symbolizing ultimate reality and human fulfillment. You may not agree with that, but he feels very strongly that that's true. Then he goes on and traces how that came through Calvinism. And I'm not picking on Calvin just because he's Calvinistic, but he tended to lend to this kind of thinking some very useful categories. For instance, when he translated the law code into the institutes, which were like the Roman Emperor Justinian's institutes, it made it sound like a state. And he also proposed the highest human vocation is law, the lawyer's work, because the lawyer work resembles the essential divine activity, legislation. Set it up again for the state. And then there are aspects of that. Then there were the Enlightenment thinkers like Thomas Jefferson, the deist Thomas Jefferson, and Nixon and McGovern were in this same order, even though were opposite ends. They were the same ones who were enlightened. The drama of human salvation is being worked out right here. The country is the arena, the politics of the country, not just the land, is the arena in which human salvation is being worked out. And that's why there is so much interest, he says, in the Old Testament. A new Zion, the country is called, a city set on a hill, a chosen people, we live in the promised land, a light to the nations, a holy people, the kingdom of God. We named our towns Hebron, Salem, Bethel, Nazareth, New Canaan, as all part of this. American Christians tend to have an Old Testament type of Christianity, and they believe that religion must have, first of all, he thinks, political relevance. Well, he goes on to say there are some things wrong with that. The Old Testament wasn't always like that. He thinks Bella tries to justify America's attempt to develop a civil religion by pointing out that Israel did the same thing, and so it must be okay. Or he tries to show that what really had happened in Israel was that when Israel became a nation like that, it was going through a political process. It had been a natural agricultural setup. And as it moved to become more urban and product-oriented, it needed to become anti-agrarian. And the king and that form of legislation was the move that it made. And so all of the Israel stuff that is used, he thinks, in the Old Testament, was taking their move from one society to another and being very useful to them to get the people to say, hey, the way you should live is out there on a farm. What you ought to do is get together as a nation. And in order to preserve that, which he maintains was a political move, they used the symbolism of the Israelites and the children of Israel and the Israel as a nation. And he says that's the part that most Americans still buy into. American analogizes from the Old Testament with its paradigm of the entire universe as an emerging state under the sovereignty of God. When she does that, she discovers divine ratification for her own aspiration to establish a holy nation state. One people, one government, one faith, one God. And such analogizing from the Old Testament involves America in an ideology that gives religious sanction to the most destructive aspects of modern nationalism. Well, Larry's a case in point, it seems to me, as a symbol for us here. It was right to take over all of those Indian territories, Indian kingdom nations, because God's nation needed them. In the name of God, we planted the cross and came in and took it over. Whether anybody had been here before, or whether they had, in the name of God, rights, or what would happen to them ever, wasn't important. Because we were the new Israel coming in. And that was sustained by, he maintains, this attitude of the Old Testament. In modern states, as in ancient Israel, war, and he talks about how war fits into this, war is a civil ritual. We call them holy wars. Through war, the state demonstrates its ultimacy by demanding that humans sacrifice their lives for it. This explains why the basic cultic rite of civil religion is human sacrifice in warfare, and why the major holidays of the states are remembrances of great battles and its various dead. The great American leaders have often been generals and war presidents. Today we no longer sacrifice our children to nature. We feed them to the state. It is urgent, according to Richardson, that we understand this ideological bias within our traditional identification with Israel's history and religion and repudiate that part of it. He allows for another kind of Israel that is related to mercy. But this aspect of it, he thinks, we must oppose. Then he goes on to the New Testament. The New Testament seeks to displace the political legal model of ultimate reality by proposing an alternative model of man's relation to God. In the New Testament, the gospel is that which liberates us from the law. The virtue of agape is placed higher than justice, and the crucified Christ is raised above all principalities and power. In these formulae, we see the efforts of early Christianity to articulate a new model of ultimate reality, not one that was built on the legal model that the Old Testament reflected according to him. So the religion of Christianity is not merely an effective critic of civil religion. Richardson believes it's also an alternative to it. It rejects two claims: the claim of every earthly Caesar and state to be ultimate, and the claim that civil categories are adequate for conceiving of the relationship of humans to God. He thinks both of those must be rejected. Both of those, he thinks, are what people are buying into. And he says, this is why Christianity, this is a tough part, because I just was talking Kingdom of God last week in Jesus Men. This speaks to me. This is why Christianity rejects not merely the worship of an earthly king, but also the claim that God is like a king. Christianity affirms that what is higher than all earthly kings is not some heavenly king, but the suffering, crucified Christ. In this affirmation, we see that Christianity is opposing not only Rome's demand that a political ruler should be venerated, but also Israel's affirmation that that God is like a political ruler. Because it refused to conceive God's relationship to the world in the terms of a legal civil model, Christianity also rejected that the highest value in life is justice, or that man is saved by obedience to a law. And he was quick to say, that does not mean that Christianity rejects justice. Quite the contrary. The history of Christian thought has repeatedly affirmed that justice is the most important value of purely historical and natural fear. Justice is essential. But Christianity knows that life has already has a trans-historical and supernatural possibility that surpasses the very best that this world that can take place in this world and age. Christianity does not repudiate law as such, but the claim that law any longer continues as a mediator between humans and God. And that's different from the Old Testament, he says. Okay? Well, he goes on to say, therefore, that the contrast had to be then related to the church. He says the church, the institutionalized church then, becomes a focused alternative to it. When it is really the church, when it's simply imitating something else, that doesn't happen. For instance, the civitas, the state says, there are functional hierarchical differences of persons. You know, you've got a job here and then all the way down the line. The church is supposed to, when it's being the church, doesn't. It says we are all together. Now, we can work it out. When does that happen among us, you know? The second contrast is that the law is a higher principle, and Christianity says it recognizes the inequity of all civil equity. Even when you're being equal, you still aren't. The law we still must have with us, but we must measure the law by love and by our union with Christ. When we do this, we see that we must introduce a general institutional bias in the law in favor of the oppressed and the rejected. And the third difference, he points out, the former, the state, belongs to this world and this age. The latter belongs to and already lives in a world and age to come. What is novel about this is this idea, is that the spiritual or supernatural realm of life has already entered history and is already beginning to take on a concrete spatial temporal form. It ought to be done right now. The Messiah will come at the end of time. That was to come at the end of time has already come. History is not yet over, but the trans-historical is already taking place now. It isn't like just getting someday to a higher place, but that it's here, and the church is the place where that can be symbolized and lived, according to that. So he thinks there is just not simply that we ought to believe different things individually. There ought to be an institutional competitor to the state's claim to have general oversight over the whole of life and the right to determine the things relating to human fulfillment. And he feels that institutional competitor ought to be the ecclesiastical institution, the church. And then he ends up by just lining the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag on one side and the Apostles' Creed next to it. And he says, that's what he sees as the difference between civil religion and, for him, Christianity. Well, that was a lot of reading and talking at you. Do you have responses or questions? Or is it clear what he's saying?
I question, when you're talking about the state as a beast as such, and loyalty and commitment to the working out of some sort of transcendent reality within that, I think there's a lot of distinctions to be made as to how people view the state. putting McGovern and Nixon together, Eugene McCarthy, or people like that, if the state is seen as the people that comprise the state, then I think, rather than as some political entity, then the most far-reaching, in terms of people, open, efficient sort of a means of working out a lot of the good that is towards this transit seems to be through the state and not through a church which is by definition a community that excludes a lot just by its very organization.
Yeah. By the way, that definition of church is what he would reject. He says it's the dominations, the congregations are exactly not what he is talking about. It's the church's total kind of thing. I'm not therefore saying you're wrong. I'm just saying to be sure that he explicitly rejects that. He thinks it's legitimate.
What he's talking about exists, and I think the state does.
All right. Just for clarity again, too, he didn't attack either Nixon or McGovern, but he attacked their relating what they were talking about to God. It was when McGovern and Nixon both called on God to support what they were about. And in either case, one might be the nation right or wrong, and the other might be democracy, public involvement, populist stuff. But as soon as either one of those is related to God, he says, we're in trouble because of his premise that when you relate religion and any other thing, you know, those two things, of you give ultimate value to it on the one hand and you begin to define ultimate value through it on the other. So he wasn't against either Nixon or McGovern at the moment, but he was saying when they begin, and he has quotes from both, where they both related to God. That's what he was saying. And it could be as miles apart as McGovern and Nixon were, but both saying, that's the way God is. That's the way God does it.
More kindly,
all right.
Relating what you just said about religion and the state, and one gives the other power. How about religion and the church? Don't they do that to each other? And it could be just the same kind of a destructive thing as it is with the state. I mean, maybe it doesn't fit with any institutionalized thing by that.
I think you'd have to. I think Richardson, on the basis of what he said, would have to agree with you.
Isn't there another dimension of this political thing? I mean, of the people themselves. Apparently, he's trying to say that the religion. Well, you should really become political. That's what you should. You know, that's what I've been hearing.
Okay.
You really should become political because of the power of the state is really up in our minds, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder sometimes, like our Indian thing. The first thing they talk about is the economic and political and legal status of the Indians, and then they become preoccupied with it.
Sure.
But you see, when I start talking to them, people in general, about this, their real concern is not that.
Yes.
Their real concern is the human interlocking of that is their real concern.
Sure.
So when he says their real concern is the political, I would think that a more appropriate term would be a preoccupation with political, is rather than, that is not where they are. They are at this human level, but they're not able to share this in the existing institutions as much as maybe they want to. As soon as you start talking to people, you begin to say that they're not at all political, really. It's only what the media has come and helped us be, and that's the only thing we talk about.
I agree, and I think, and to be fair to Richardson again, I'd say that he wasn't talking as much about people being consciously that way as much as that they would be essentially buying in. That when people even became human, they eventually said, well, if the government gave us so-and-so, then we could do it, you know. Or if the government would let us alone, then we'd do it. But see, then it's automatically the power. There's a preoccupation with what that is above us. And I don't think he would say, I wouldn't be fair to him in saying we ought to become political. He would say we ought to become so Christian as a church that it would be seen automatically as a competitor to the state. Not to go in and, you know, let's organize and take over and apply so the church then will have a lobby. He wouldn't be saying that. He would be saying that the church ought to be such an obvious alternative to thinking the state has all the answers, that it would be competition. Because now he feels the church isn't, or churches and congregations and are so cut up in little pieces. He says that's why they bless all the little denominations. But if the church would become one in some way or not, and it never happened as you said, that would be seen more as competition to the state.
When he defines the state, does he really talk about a bureaucracy? Is that equal?
No, he talks. He includes that, but not limited to that. The whole political process of electing, and, you know, locally and regionally and all that business, and then what comes about when you do elect people to do things, and that is the bureaucracy. He would include all of it. But including the fact that you elect the president, you elect the mayor, you elect the clerk, you elect the that whole political process, he would include, and includes a lot of bureaucracy in the way it carries out back to you, like Indian affairs or something like that. That would be included, but he would include the other part of it as well.
I think possibly in the teaching of history, especially to high schoolers and such, we almost indoctrinate them with the notion that the church is not an alternative. By the way, so often the way our country was founded and how it was approached from a religious standpoint,
yeah,
and the fact that these religious governments failed, the fact that they were very narrow, the fact that they did not have answers, we almost automatically are saying that religion, look, our government has the answers, religion does not. See what's happened in our history. And also going through our history, we find religion backing up slavery.
Yeah.
Like you say, religion helping us take over the land from the idiot Indians. This bad connotation,
yeah,
what we consider evil now, this is taught too. In a way, it almost says that there is no religious structure that can have the answers. They are always they're fleeting. They don't have a steady base for you. The government does, because it's law, we have the constitution, this and that. But religion is the emotions of men. This is not a steady base.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see Francis Schaeffer, you probably know of him. I've just been viewing some of his films that he's made from Roman times to the present.
No, I haven't seen it.
Well, he is trying to show the other side. He is showing that the downfall of nations, according to his theory, the downfall of nations has come because they have been based on the frailty of man, of mind, and man's ideas rather than on God,
mm-hmm,
and some real constant source of oneness, which is in the Bible, according to him. It's interesting to see his reversal. But getting back to that, I think we almost indoctrinate this in our kids, I think, by the way we approach it. Church is negative. Everything is negative that has to do with church and religion. Mm-hmm. Our movies, you know, all the bad guys are always pastors, you know, or preachers or something. They're always the nuts, mm-hmm, and things like that, as we see. But I think it's a shame that there's not a proper perspective here.
Just buying into your last comment, I think it's really interesting how making fun of church and religion today is really in and accepted. Whereas if you started doing that with the Indians or blacks or women, there'd be a scream to high heaven, you know, and I would join in the scream. But no scream about making fun of religious institutions or anything else. And again, I would feel badly if there were no satire or parody or realistic talking about that. But the fact that it seems to be the unquestioned area of parody. Nobody raises a question about it. You know, you assume what the preacher really was at. He wanted to go to bed with somebody. That was what it was about. That's essential, that's what human beings are. And nobody says, oh, well, that's all right. And, you know, and they say it long enough, loud enough, well enough, often enough, they'll buy in.
Well, this minority thing, though, there are a lot of things that are being said and done that I could scream to high heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
you understand it better than we. That's right.
You know, it's like this, one of the Holden people here across the table, you know. He says, oh, you're in the Indian work. And then he goes into this whole business about how he has collected Indian things for X number of years, and
yeah,
that whole thing. And then, so he's talking about his Indian collection. He collects Indian things. Well, we went on for about 10 minutes or so. I had to make the comment, though. I couldn't resist it. that, you know, for about 20, 25 years, I've collected white things.
Bless you.
But, you know, there is really a lot of stereotyping being done. You know.
Well, I'm into white work. That's good. That's a helpful comment, Larry. Go ahead.
I wonder if it'd be interesting to just think in terms of perhaps the last 15 years, and then I also would like to have us talk perhaps 5 years ahead of what are the issues when civil religion has really come to the surface? When have we observed it being more active? Just so we can, relate it to what we see happening today and what might happen, especially in this current administration.
What comes to your mind?
One thing that I have felt for quite a while was that the strong resistance to the protesters of the Vietnam War was a threat to many people to their civil religion. They didn't see it as that, but I felt that was that's one time when I think the civil religion was very active.
In other words, the pro-war people tended to say the nation couldn't have made a mistake. It had to be right if we went in there. And the war person would say, hey, we were wrong. And the civil religion would say, you can't be wrong because the state is close to God. Is that a fair kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much that. Okay. You know, they just couldn't see their nation as being that wrong because it was too tied up with
God.
Yeah.
Maybe the women's rights movement is working out that, okay, within the Constitution, these are our freedoms and rights. And as Americans, how can you deny that to people? I mean, it's...
Sure. And civil religion tends to be, like many other religions, male and white, maybe not as much Anglo-Saxon anymore. So I think that that's a threat to American civil religion because the country tends to be based on a male-dominant God, seen only in male terms, and male prophets. You know, I don't think there was. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. You're helpful. I don't think there was one quote from a woman in that book. Mm-hmm. Right on. And I didn't see that. I recognized that no woman had written. I saw that quite clearly and quite quickly. Although there are women who could write in this field. So Jones and Ritchie chose their own. But I don't remember a quote. Hoo-wee.
That's right, the Bible is used. But quotes from the Bible are used. As saying, you know, this is woman's place.
Oh, yes, I agree. Yeah, that's right.
So I hadn't thought in terms of woman's place in relation to...
That's interesting.
I was just along that same line. I just a thought came to my head that possibly women, though, today are at the forefront, with minorities, actually, but at the forefront of this change in our society, the ecology, all the way to the ecology the relationships of people. It seems like there's so many more authors and writers are women than ever before along these lines. And very much accepted.
Sure.
And quoted along those lines.
Right.
Not along political lines and religious lines yet, but along human lines. And it seems that women are becoming extremely predominant.
Yeah.
Just as a
observation. Yeah. But Sheila Collins, who has written a feminist theology entitled A Different Heaven and a Different Earth, has much to say about this. Of course, now her book came out after this thing was published. But there are people, women, who have already theologically spoken clearly in this field, too. It may be a time lapse kind of thing. Yeah. Any more areas? Where have we seen civil religion raise its head? Vietnam War, women's thing, possibly. We don't have to get union. You don't have to agree with all, but what are other kinds of things? Anyone?
Well, just the political process itself, voting, people getting together from the grassroots on, picking candidates, going to conventions, the hullabaloo, one thing or another, the rights of the voters.
So the campaign process that you're talking about, that's where civil religion tends to be seen.
The issues are not basic.
Uh-huh.
Other things are basic to political campaigns. Okay. What you say, how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
The out has the advantage of bringing forth the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
The in has the advantage of trying to defend, or disadvantage of having to try to defend what the dreams that they didn't fulfill.
Yeah.
Plus what they haven't done, things like that, and bringing up what they haven't done. It seems like if issues, political issues, and the good of the country in the sense of the political, or the people, you know, the political aspect, you probably have less of a religiosity to it than a blue. No issues. I vote for the man whose eyes are colored blue. He combs his hair on the right side. He doesn't scratch his butt or something.
I guess Watergate. Certainly
yeah, I was assuming we'd mention that.
And what's the name of the guy who turned over the papers? I can't remember the name of the guy. You know,
who did? What was the name?
Just a second.
Charles.
You're not thinking of Colson.
No.
No, but the other guy. The guy who did about the break in and the psychiatrist's office and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
You know, where he.
Yeah.
He did it because for love of his
Ellsberg.
Country.
David Ellsberg?
Ellsberg, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it would, you know.
He said that he, you know, the reason he did that was because he was being true to his country, and of course, many people felt he was a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting that, you know, the two sides to that. Some say that he is the true patriot.
Oh, yeah.
And then also the ones who burned the draft cards are the true patriots. Mm-hmm. The ones who left the country to avoid were the true patriots, mm-hmm. because they were proving the right instead of.
Sure.
The amnesty issue.
Yeah, the amnesty.
Amnesty issue would be one where civil religion has been involved.
I tend to link capitalism with selfishness somehow as being a holy area too. We're just kind of striving to control and own more things and to be protective of our own interests.
Mm-hmm.
And then that this has become so vicious now that it's really...
And that would be clearly American civil religion in this sense that it's based on the Calvinistic principle, and I'm, again, not picking on Calvin because we all got... Luther had his other kinds of things, for instance, that played into this. And that is that you got what you earned, and only, you know, and if you were a good person and worked hard, you would succeed. Therefore, capitalism, where you get money, is succeeding, and God likes it. So the it's specifically related to American civil religion. That doesn't mean that there can't be some basis for it beyond American civil religion. Clearly, that's true also, but it is. And that's why in recent times, inflation and the recession and all of that stuff, people were saying, you know, well, all right, this is the way it works, and not always saying explicitly, God will work it out. But it's assumed that you don't take any drastic action. You don't move against a corporation. You don't move towards different salaries with the unions or any of that business because God blesses our capitalistic system, which, as you say, is based on the premise, mostly today, well, I think maybe all the time, on the premise of getting. I think
it's amazing that under the same light, there's also charity. We are not, but we like to think of ourselves as being the most charitable country in the world because we are tremendously charitable.
That's
we
right.
Give under the same thing, and we take. There's two things working here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's strange how we always give to the stranger and not to each other.
Oh, yeah.
It's easier.
Anybody else on seeing where it is raised?
I came in really late on this, David. Civil religion means that you are working, you are God-inspired, working for change in the government.
No, it means that one sees the government, the political process, as being connected somehow to God, whatever is happening. It might be status quo, you know, our nation, love it or leave it. Because that's the way God wanted us to be. We are called by God to be Americans, to be a savior of the world. It might be that. It doesn't have to be all these things I'm saying, but I'm using illustrations of it. Or it might be, the other end of that would be, we are called by God to change.
To make a stand one way or
another. Right.
Yeah,
whatever. Right. But whatever the political process, including all of governmental processes, is doing, to see that related to God, either specifically with the word God, as Marty points out in one area, or with self-transcendence, that we are greater. Even though we don't use the word God, there is an ultimate value to the American way, politically or lifestyle or whatever it is, that is better because it is ultimate. So that's what the definition, and it doesn't have any doctrines in the sense all set, because it could be any one of those things. And God is seeing as changing. God adjusts, depending on where the civil religion appears. So, is that...
But you're talking about civil religion as opposed to the other government, the government that is.
Well, they're saying that these people who were wrote in this book said, I'll read that first line again by Bella. It doesn't really do with different kinds of government as much as he thinks. There actually exists, alongside of and rather clearly differentiated from the churches, an elaborate and well institutionalized civil religion in America. A religion that has to do with political process rather than with revealed God or whatever else it may be. Churches or synagogues or Eastern religions or whatever else, those things. Those are seen as one. But he thinks there is a well elaborate and well institutionalized civil religion in which the state and God are somehow molded together. And he thinks most Americans believe more in that, by the way they act, than they believe in their commitment to their specific denominational faith or God faith, as they talk about.
Would legislation on questions like abortion or capital punishment be an equating of the state? The fact that those issues are definitely...
Yeah. Certainly would have a denominational aspect to it, because Catholicism and some Protestants are very much active in it. But in addition, there is a civil religion dimension of it, I think. Yeah.
When people get involved in this civil religion sort of thing, are we taking the stand that because we are Christian and we're doing this, that we're doing it for God and for something ultimate?
He thinks that...
Or is there no other way? When we do it, we think that it has to be, it is a plot, in our mind, it's a positive, good thing, and that only right can come out of it?
Yeah.
Or do we take, or under this civil religion, is there a possibility that whatever we endeavor with a wholesome spirit can go either way? It can be... it can be accomplished, or maybe there is a risk that it won't be accomplished, and whatever way it turns out is God's will.
They talk about it. Marty particularly talks about different kinds of civil religion. One includes the possibility of right and wrong, because it sees God beyond the state making judgments against it. But another aspect of the same kind of civil religion is when the state itself becomes God, and so the right or wrong doesn't come into it, and it's usually my country, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's seen as right, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. He maintains, by the way, all of us are in civil religion. Nobody chooses to be in. He's saying the whole country, you, I, everyone else, have bought in to a civil religion. And what they're trying to say is that we ought to be aware of it. We may not like it. If we become conscious of it, we may not be conscious. He maintains that most people are not conscious of it. They wouldn't dream that it exists. But his contention is that it does exist, and that it is as real, and maybe more real, than the other one.
Please, actually.
Sure.
And the argument was between two sides, which are pretty much half and half, really. One side that said, no, our people here in this community want us to teach patriotism. We are to cause these students to become patriotic. And the other says, no, we are here to cause these students to question and to think,
yeah,
and to learn our history in the sense that, well, how can we better this country? How can we better by our past experience? Well, how we've led to these things, like putting down memories in the country. And the patriotism won, by the way, won the issue.
I'll bet.
It's going to be based on patriotism. Once again, it's been that way. But I think here is one of the strongest America, right or wrong type of attitude, I think, starts at this point. And you can't fight the vocal group in your community that come to you and say, I don't like the way you're teaching history. I want more patriotism. I don't want my kids coming home questioning my country and denying that it's wonderful. I want, you know, this type of thing. I want them to come home and say how great it is and then go out and fight and get themselves killed for any reason. It's
very difficult to fight. And if you told them that they were participating in a civil religion, they would hotly...
That never came up.
I wouldn't have thought about it until... Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they would deny it.
Exactly what we would do.
I would have denied it. My own self. I do that. Mm-hmm. But now I do.
I think there's one positive thing that's happening in our country, and that's going to the metric system. We have finally admitted that there might be a system that's a little better than the one we've had.
Yeah.
So I'm really delighted with that because
The signs.
People objected to the highway signs.
And that was voted down. I couldn't remember if that was just in the state of Oregon or.
No, no.
That was the whole.
Yeah, we got it. Ours are going to be taken down.
Too bad.
We have somewhere. We have 160, and what do you mean? That they want them out. Back to the miles.
Back.
We got intended.
We've always.
I too. Yeah, you know, I mean that's what people would be saying. The way God intended. Let's go back to that. You know.
The signs of we hiked the Donkey Lake, and the signs up the Donkey Lake are all in kilometers, and I'm so delighted.
Oh, all the parks, the national parks system.
Yeah, they're moving.
But the kilometers first and the miles in parentheses instead of the miles first and the kilometers.
Well, I don't care which goes first.
Well, I think it's a statement.
It messes up religion and it messes up society both because now they're finding they have to rewrite the history books, get off of Manifest Destiny and so on, go back, include the blacks, change some of the what we call massacres. You know,
yeah.
Change the names from strategic victories to massacres.
That's right. Yes.
Really, it actually messes up both sides.
You're right.
If religion would be, you know, kind of the prick of conscience to society and continue to be that, it would keep society honest, and then society could keep religion honest by always coming back and saying, but you guys always talk about love, but you don't live it.
Yeah.
When we get such a close friendship, which kind of scares me with Carter, is, you know, the things he's doing in terms of human rights is beautiful, but it's still the responsibility of the religious community to be the prick of conscience that makes that possible. And as soon as we start sleeping in the same bed again, we're right back to the same old problems. And I think we've got to keep each other honest. And that's not loading the guns and shooting at each other, but that's a good, healthy relationship.
I think so too.
A healthy husband and wife.
Sure.
When they really keep each other honest, they both grow. When they start either becoming one personality or the other, they're in trouble.
Yep. I agree. That's why just the privatism of individual faith is such a dirt. And Carter may affirm more of that till people say, oh, well, the way to be is, you know, just get more in touch with your own God and be by yourself. And to be corporate and responsive to what's going on around, as well as even to Carter, to keep that touch there, that we want to be, say, hey, Jimmy, yes, but maybe no, and all this kind of business. That's important. I agree.
Yeah, like I say, the more moral a man is, the more it scares me, because he does so much right that you begin to put
the camera on everything.
Yeah.
Trust the moral man.
It was healthier with Nixon, where you knew there was so
much right. Yeah. I agree. I think one of the most dangerous things is the biblical, or the banner he's flying under, as he says, for all of us in the country.
A lot of healthy things happen, but the great danger is to be sucked into it and not be critical.
Young, he is bringing out points that have to be brought out about Africa. We're not ready for it as a country, but I think we have to also find ways of showing what is right about what he is doing. I think Carter's going to lose on people like Young.
Probably so, but it's like the woman that took the first step on the bus. You know, when will it happen? We better start. Young might be needed, and Young might be a gamble.
Yeah, it'd be a shame to have him voted out of office because he's right.
It's good to swallow hard a little while and hear some of those statements, even as foolhardy as they are in terms of international policy. Man, you sit back and say, I can't believe some people are really saying it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Out loud. These people are really being honest. It scares me, you know?
Yeah, something's got to be wrong.
Yeah.
What crooked thing are they doing? Yeah.